Shift is brought to you by BorgWarner. At BorgWarner, we are on a mission to deliver innovative and sustainable mobility solutions for the vehicle market. It's all part of our accelerated shift toward electrification, helping us to achieve our vision of a cleaner, more energy-efficient world. To learn more, visit BorgWarner.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Shift, a podcast about mobility. I'm your host, Pete Bigelow.
Hi, Pete. Hi, everybody. This is Leslie Allen, and welcome to the show.
Joining us on the podcast today is Asad Hussain, Senior Mobility Analyst at PitchBook. We're going to talk about the big Ford news this week. We're going to talk about air mobility, ride hailing, a whole lot more. We're going to really span the mobility world in our conversation with Asad, and he'll give us a good perspective on what investors are looking at these days. But first, Leslie, obviously, I just mentioned the big news this week. Huge news, in fact. Ford is investing $7 billion, its biggest investment in its 118-year history in terms of manufacturing, in three battery plants and an electric pickup truck manufacturing facility. They're going all in. What do you make of it?
Wow, this is huge news for Ford and for those communities that are going to be getting those jobs with these plants that are coming in. Just to add a little more to that, it looks like Ford is going to be setting up a 3,600-acre mega campus northeast of Memphis that it's going to call Blue Oval City. And that's going to include Ford's as you mentioned, first new assembly plant in more than 50 years. It's three times the size of the Rouge complex. If anyone has been to Detroit, the Rouge complex is humongous. I mean, it's huge. And they're going to hire about 6,000 people. And they're going to be making the next gen electric F-Series pickups. And there's also a project in Louisville, the Louisville area, for a 1,500-acre battery park, which is doing with SK Innovation. So overall, huge news for Ford, huge news for these communities that are going to be getting these jobs, and really underlines how important electric vehicles are going to be for automotive in the next several years.
You know, it's interesting, Leslie. It's huge news, as you mentioned, for the communities getting these jobs, maybe huge news for the communities not getting these jobs as well, i.e. Michigan. I think you saw the comments from Governor Gretchen Whitmer that kind of expressed some regret that Ford didn't consider locating these jobs here where we are in Southeast Michigan. I guess it brings a question to me, would be, will another assembly plant ever get built in Michigan? What do you think the backstory is there?
You know, I don't have the answer to that, Pete, but Ford was quick to point out that it has invested more than $7 billion in Michigan since 2016. I think that there are some concerns, at least for the SK Innovation plants that are coming in, about whether or not those will be union plants. So that might have something to do with it. But it's pretty obvious that we're seeing a shifting paradigm right now. And many of the EV companies that are the hottest ones on the market right now are not union. So we'll see how that plays out.
I was going to say, Leslie, it's a continuation of the new Southern auto industry, but it's not so new anymore. This has been going on for decades at this point. And, you know, you have to wonder if that trend will ever reverse. And by all signs right now, the answer is no. So big news. Why don't we go to our conversation with Asad Hussain? We won't talk about the UAW and union aspects so much, but he will give us some terrific perspective on what this means for the future of electric cars. And without further ado, we'll go to our conversation with Asad Hussain from PitchBook. Asad, thanks so much for joining us today on the podcast. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the big news this week, which I think is clearly the news out of Ford, that they are making the single biggest manufacturing investment in their 118-year history, $7 billion for an electric truck factory and three battery factories. What does this investment signal to you overall? And does it preordain the fact that this shift to electric is really going to happen?
Yeah. I think it's fantastic. I think, you know, Ford is doing a smart thing, which is they're trying to reinvent themselves as a company to better position themselves for a future that will be battery electric. You know, I think this shift is here to stay. I think this move by Ford is a signal that that's, you know, it's actually happening. And, you know, they're willing to put their investments on the line to make that a reality. And I think, you know, it's sorely needed, right? It's something that, you know, we need to shift to electric. We need to have those investments in place. You can't, you know, move to electric when you don't have dedicated manufacturing capacity to do so. I think, you know, Ford actually doing that is a big signal to the market that they're serious about that. And it's going to spur other competitors in the market that maybe have been a little bit laggard in investing in EV technology to rethink some of that. And, you know, I think more broadly, it just signals, you know, more and more automakers taking a more active role in, you know, not just putting out EV models, but actually taking a more active stake in their entire EV battery supply chain. And so, you know, this Ford announcement is an example of that. But I also think what's interesting is the Ford partnership with Redwood Materials announced a few days ago, which is mirroring kind of the GM LG Chem partnership with Li-Cycle. You know, it's not enough to build EVs if you, you know, A, are not able to get the critical battery materials you need because there's a, you know, a shortage forecast over the next 10 years of crucial materials like lithium, cobalt, nickel, et cetera. And B, if you are able to get those materials, if they're not environmentally or ethically sustainably sourced, that's a big problem for these companies. And I think it's great to see automakers like Ford really stepping up to the table and seeking to be proactive and invest more in EV technology and EV manufacturing capacity and also EV sustainability.
There's so much that you just mentioned that I want to ask you about. Why don't I start with recycling? What is the role of recycling over the medium term in and kind of fixing those supply chain constraints?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, you know, it's a couple of things, right? Battery recycling is going to play a crucial role in closing the loop and creating environmentally friendly and environmentally sustainable EV supply chains. Right now, you know, lithium extraction, a lot of the methods used to extract lithium are not very environmentally friendly. They require a lot of water, a lot of water pollution that has, you know, negative externalities to the people, communities, the ecosystems, the animals around them. So that's kind of one problem that battery recycling can solve, especially with more advanced recycling techniques like hydrometallurgy in terms of reducing that emissions and environmental impact. And, you know, ultimately not having to mine for new materials as much. So that's a crucial part of it. But then I also think an equally important part of what's driving this push to battery recycling is the desire to have, you know, a domestic supply of battery materials where you're not reliant on foreign supply chains and potential disruptions, right? We're all seeing what's going on in supply chains, especially in automotive. And you know, I think it's clear to the automakers today, the Fords, the GMs of the world, they're seeing this going on. They want to reduce their reliance on, you know, lithium mines in Chile or Australia or wherever they are, and battery manufacturing facilities in Asia. If we can bring that domestically, I think that's going to be huge. And I think that's why you're seeing, you know, the Biden administration really push that as well, providing frameworks for doing that and potentially funding as well. You know, we need to have resilient supply chains that are that can survive sort of supply chain shocks. And then the final part of that is the labor aspect, right? Especially with cobalt mining, for example, which, you know, there can be some dubious labor practices there, reducing dependency on that. So I think all of this is about ultimately creating more sustainable supply chains from both an environmental, an ethical, and a resiliency perspective.
What is the supply chain crunch that you see coming? I think you've written at the middle of this decade.
Yeah, I think, you know, from what I've seen, there's a lot of forecasts out there that are looking out at the, you know, the sort of market trajectory of EVs and how we're at this huge inflection point that's going to be happening basically throughout this decade. And essentially, our infrastructure, our manufacturing capacity, our battery processing capacity, our lithium mines that are up and running, you know, likely won't be able to keep up with that. And so I think that's a big part of why you're likely to see lithium prices expand going forward as that mismatches, as that mismatch occurs. And, you know, more importantly, I think you'll see shortages, right? We won't be able to satisfy the demand for EVs that's going to be out there. And I think you're going to see a continuation of, you know, right now, a lot of the focus is on semiconductors. And so you're seeing long wait times for consumers trying to buy vehicles. I think it's sort of in the mid decade, you're going to see those sort of wait times, but with EVs, as there's so much demand for EVs, which are going to be, you know, really, really high performance in demand vehicles that are going to be subsidized by rebates and things like that and tax incentives. But at the end of the day, a lot of these automakers won't be able to make as many to fulfill the demand.
So this is crazy to think about, because I keep hearing that as automakers ramp up their volume, that costs will fall. But on the other hand, you're telling me that there's going to be a scarcity of lithium that will drive up prices. So are we not going to see prices for EVs fall as volume ramps up?
I think so. I think we still will. But I think the risk is that, you know, at the end of the day, the supply chains won't be equipped to supply these vehicles. So I think, you know, one thing I'm keeping a close eye on is to see more announcements like this one by Ford, but also more, you know, expansions of lithium mining capacity, battery manufacturing facilities, et cetera. The whole supply chain really needs to be ready for this shift going forward if we are to drive the, you know, affordability aspect of reducing the end costs for consumers, bringing those battery costs down as they have been over the past decade. For EVs to be accessible for everyone, they need to be affordable.
Within the last month, beyond the Ford announcement, we've seen Rivian and Lucid both roll their vehicles off assembly lines. It makes me think big picture, like really since World War II, only Tesla has been a you know, startup that succeeded. And the auto industry is kind of littered with the bones of other startups that have fallen by the wayside. What's the chance that so many of these companies survives in the long run? And what does it take for today's EV startups to succeed?
Yeah, that's a good question. Agreed. Like it's very rare for a new automaker to be able to come in and be successful. And I don't think that fundamental paradigm is too different today. It's still an intensely challenging proposition, whether or not it's a battery electric vehicle or an internal combustion engine. And you've seen that with the issues that Tesla has gone through, the production hell, and how they've been, you know, Elon Musk has talked about them being weeks away from catastrophe. So I think it's, you know, it's definitely a challenging prospect for these new entrants. But at the same time, you know, I want to recognize that we are in unprecedented times with the level of capital availability to these new upstarts, new EV makers, new mobility players in the space. There is a ton of capital that's maybe been on the sidelines that is going into the space from generalist investors, from large asset managers, from investors with really, really deep pockets to make this these new upstarts into a reality. And, you know, that kind of solves a lot of the fundamental problem is at the end of the day, it's a very capital intensive industry ramping up production of new vehicles. And so, you know, that capital is there today in a way that it hasn't been, you know, a decade ago or two decades ago, I think. So that gives me confidence in some of the leading companies in the space, the leading EV upstarts like the Rivians and the Lucids of the world. But at the same time, I do think at the end of the day, a lot of these startups that are trying to do this are going to face unprecedented financial and operational challenges. And, you know, it's likely going to be the case that a lot of them fail.
Asad, you mentioned that investors have really warmed up in a way that, you know, perhaps they haven't in the past to electric vehicles. Does that apply to automakers, or are you talking about battery developments and EV charging infrastructure startups as well? Is there money flowing there, and how does that help this ecosystem survive and or succeed?
I think it's all of the above. I think, you know, a lot more focus on automakers, especially the ones that are sort of reinventing themselves to be more focused on electric, the way Ford is, for example. But I think the Polestar spec is a great example of that, you know, an offshoot of a legacy automaker that's, you know, spinning out and going public as an EV name at a, you know, really, really premium valuation, you could argue. And you know, that's obviously benefiting from the Lucid, the Tesla, the Rivian phenomenon that we've seen happen. But I think, you know, at the same time, I think a lot of investors are looking at, you know, how can we invest in the future of electrification without betting on a single automaker? Because that is still such a risky proposition. And a lot of them, frankly, might not even be able to get exposure to the names that they want, like the Rivians or the Lucids of the world. How can we invest in things that will be equally as important to the development of this overall ecosystem in terms of supporting it? You know, the picks and shovels of the EV revolution. When I think about that, I think about, you know, charging infrastructure, battery manufacturing, battery recycling, you know, in-car connectivity, autonomous, you know, mobility as a service. There's so many ways to kind of play this larger trend, which at the end of the day, I think the fundamental thesis underlying all of this investment is that we're at the early innings of a multi-decade transformation in our transportation systems, moving to electric, connected, autonomous, and shared. And there's just so much appetite to finance this shift. And it's happening now. We're all seeing it playing out in front of us. Get on board. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a tech company, you know, a hospitality company. At the end of the day, we're all kind of touched by this shift. And if you're not investing in it, or at least preparing yourself for that shift, you risk being left behind when it does happen.
Let me ask you a question about that big picture shift that you just outlined. In your Q2 report that you wrote for PitchBook, you noted that venture capital funds had pumped, I'm looking at it now, $48.7 billion year to date into mobility startups. You know, at this point in early October, how has the year continued to unfold, and how does that number compare to previous years?
Yeah, I wish we were talking a week from now, because I would get that data in a week. So maybe I'll follow up with you once we have that. But look, so far in the year, I'll phrase it like this. So far in the year, mobility investment has been really, really strong. And I think you're seeing what's driving that is just a lot more interest from generalist investors, large asset managers, investors that historically have maybe shunned investing in the space because they've seen how, you know, asset heavy a lot of the businesses are, how capital intensive they can be, and just fundamentally how risky maybe investing in the space has seemed, especially to the venture community, which is really focused on software and scalability through software, and less focus on hardware, where maybe they see it as a more of a low margin transportation cyclical business that's hard to drive meaningful returns. I think the past year and a half has totally upended that narrative with the dozens and dozens of EV and mobility companies that have gone public through SPACs and largely been very successful in doing so. I think, you know, if you're a venture investor, you're looking at that and maybe it's leading you to kind of rethink some of your previous assumptions about the space in terms of what startups are or aren't venture backable. And so I think, you know, as you're seeing this larger shift play out in terms of the shift to electric, I think what I'm hearing is that a lot of sort of generalist investors or investors that have shunned areas like, you know, battery tech or, you know, charging infrastructure, things like that, they're now coming back to those spaces and looking for exposure to those names. Because again, I think, you know, they don't want to be left out. They don't want to be left behind of this huge technological shift.
So you wrote in the same report I referenced, and I quote, "Successful exiting no longer necessitates successfully commercializing." That decoupling seems concerning in some way. What should we make of this?
Yeah. I think it says a lot about the market environment that we're in, where, you know, you just have at the end of the day, I think the underlying driver is that, you know, there's a ton of dry powder out there. There's a ton of capital out there that's looking for yield. And there's, you know, maybe not as many options out there. And so investors really are looking for, you know, what's the next big thing? A lot of them are looking at EVs and mobility. And, you know, that's having an impact across the space from, you know, obviously these SPACs that we've seen in the public companies like Tesla, which have seen big valuation boosts and receiving ton of capital, ultimately, which I think is, you know, going to help them succeed in the long term. But also we're seeing in the private markets with later stage startups, you know, Series C, Series D, Series E and higher, they're seeing a significant boost to their valuations. And so I think a big question mark out there in the industry is, hey, is this sustainable? Are we in like some sort of EV bubble that's all going to come crashing down? And look, my opinion is this. We're, you know, the industry is still in early days. We're still in flux. There are definitely going to be more losers than winners. But at the same time, even if there is a bit of a pullback, I think at the end of the day, we're still at the early innings of a multi-decade transformation in mobility. And so the winners, we're going to look back on them 20 years from now, the way that we kind of look back at Amazon today during the dot-com bubble, right? As emerging as, you know, maybe among a bunch of losers, but at the end of the day, sort of being at the forefront of a huge technological transformation and reaping a ton of rewards and also, you know, transforming the world as we know it today.
It'd be amazing to revisit this conversation in 25 years or so, look back and see, you know, what fundamental assumptions are right or wrong. And maybe along those lines, do you see one mode emerging as a long-term winner in that transformation? And I guess I ask that in the context of the air mobility, for lack of a better word, hype that we see today. And, you know, where does that kind of fit into this mobility picture?
Yeah, by mode, do you mean like transportation option? Or what do you mean by mode?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I see, you know, electric vehicles right now being a, you know, obviously a big driver, as we've talked about. We haven't yet talked about trucking, but perhaps freight leads this long run, or do we look, you know, away from the ground and, or, you know, traditional vehicles per se? Is it rail? Is it eVTOLs? Is there one that emerges as, oh, we should have seen that sector taking off?
One thing I would want to call out there is I think you hit on something really important, which is at the end of the day, transportation and mobility is not just about cars, right? And I think one crucial mistake that I see a lot of investors and frankly incumbents in the space that are active in the space, one mistake I see is that, you know, existing paradigms tend to be really, really car focused. And tend to think about the future of transportation, about the future of automotive technology. And don't get me wrong, that's really important. Obviously, EVs, you know, in-car connectivity, autonomous as it relates to the car, all of that is going to be super, super important. But I think you risk falling into a trap of pattern matching, where you're then looking at technologies that fit your sort of perception of how cars look today and missing out on some of the really, really big opportunities over the next 10, 20 years, a lot of which I think will be outside of passenger vehicles. And so what do I mean by that? I mean, micromobility, e-scooters, e-bikes, other types of smaller form factor, light electric vehicles that are going to be really crucial for changing the way people move and making mobility much more accessible, affordable, and convenient to people in dense cities, not only in the US, but across the world, especially in markets where car ownership is impractical or overly expensive. That's going to be a huge transformation. That's going to be hugely important. And you think about, you know, the rise of last mile delivery and rapid delivery with, you know, companies like Getter and Gorillas really revolutionizing what it means to have goods delivered to you. It doesn't make sense for couriers in dense cities to be delivering, you know, items within 10 minutes, you know, a small radius with cars, right? They're going to be using cargo bikes. And so I think micromobility is an important part of that shift. I think trucking freight is an important part of that shift because of the labor shortage we have. And I think when we look at technologies like autonomous, there's a lot of hype around moving people around and disrupting the Ubers and Lyfts of the world. But I think the market for moving goods around, it's going to, you know, you're going to see much faster adoption of that. And we're going to be touched by that, frankly, a lot quicker than we are going to be ferried around ourselves by autonomous technology. And so that encompasses the entire supply chain from, you know, middle mile, last mile, final mile delivery to, you know, movement within warehouses, off-road applications like construction and mining, airport logistics, you name it. All of those areas are ripe for automation, and it's happening right now. And then finally, you know, air mobility, which, you know, is just a huge topic of conversation right now. But ultimately, I think it's going to shape the way goods and people move, probably goods first, but definitely people as well over the long term. And it's really going to change the way, you know, we interact with like hubs from cities, suburban hubs, and that sort of long distance travel. When does it make sense to charter a flight or take a road trip? I think, you know, air mobility is going to provide a new avenue. Air taxis, long distance air taxis like Joby and Archer, for example. But also on the logistics side, where, you know, you have companies like Beta Technologies, Elroy Air, and others that are really going to be revolutionizing and expanding capacity and supply chains by enabling routes that would not otherwise exist. Working with companies like FedEx and UPS and Amazon to help them, you know, more streamline, make their supply chains more efficient and fast. So, you know, I guess kind of just to tie all this together, what I would say is that what I'm seeing is that there's a lot of excitement in the space, but I would caution investors from pattern matching too much when they think about the future of mobility and transportation. Think outside the car, and, you know, also think outside of consumer transportation. Think about the commercial side, fleet managements, and what's going to happen with supply chains. That's what the smart investors are doing, I feel like, in this space.
We'll have more of Pete's conversation with Asad Hussain from PitchBook right after this.
At BorgWarner, we're leading the way to a cleaner, more energy-efficient future. By accelerating our shift toward electrification, we're pursuing a high-impact evolution, one that prioritizes sustainability company-wide. What does this mean for BorgWarner? The products we deliver now, and those that we will deliver in the future, all make the world more energy efficient. With an extensive history in product leadership and an expertise in developing state-of-the-art technologies, we are advancing the future of electrified vehicles. We've also increased our plant efficiency, working to make continual improvements across global operations through new and innovative manufacturing practices. This all drives toward a commitment to our goal of being carbon neutral in our Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions by 2035. Sound ambitious? That's because it is. We're at the forefront of our industry for a reason, and our shift toward electrification helps advance our vision. In order to create a clean, energy-efficient world, we'll continue to rely upon our greatest resource, our people. By empowering diverse teams and offering flexible solutions, we are well positioned to drive the next generation of clean and sustainable mobility products. While accelerating this shift toward electrification may be good for business, it's about so much more. At BorgWarner, it's about creating a better, more sustainable world for our people, customers, communities, and planet.
Now, more with Asad Hussain.
So in terms of autonomy, if I hear you right, it sounds like you're saying that both on the ground in the air, we're going to see cargo moved before humans. And I'm wondering, is that because the unit economics pencil out better, or because there's less risk involved in moving cargo than humans, or both? Why is that?
Yeah, great question. It's a couple of things. I think the risk factor is huge, right? When you're carrying people, and it's not just the risk of, it's the risk of accidents. It's the risk of, you know, potential loss of life. It's also the regulatory risk and the PR risk of, you know, are people going to be afraid of getting in an autonomous vehicle or in an air taxi if something goes wrong? You need people, you need more demand than supply for those services to work and recoup the investments that they've made. And then on the regulatory side, the hurdles for, you know, adoption, commercializing those services are going to be higher when you're moving people around. And people have higher kind of expectations for a consumer service, right? If someone rides in an autonomous vehicle and it gets stuck on the side of the road, or gets into an accident, right? Like, they're not going to accept that. That's just not acceptable. But if you're moving goods around, I think the safety thresholds are a little bit lower because you're not going to be in super dense populated areas to the same extent where there's tons of pedestrians around and a real risk of something going wrong. And the consumer experience doesn't really matter as much, right? If it's as long as it's not like a mission critical delivery, it's not a huge deal if the vehicle gets stuck on like a back road somewhere and needs some help to get to its final destination. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is, I think the problem is a little bit easier to solve, right? It's more fixed routes, less variability, less dense traffic. So I think, that aspect just makes the technological development happen a lot more quickly, where the actual operating design domain is a bit of an easier one than when you're dealing with a ton of unpredictable traffic as you would in a city center, for example. One thing is really, really important and a reason why I think you're going to see adoption of a lot of this technology in supply chains and commercial goods is that's where you have a demand pull, not necessarily a demand push. And what I mean by that is, when you're a robotaxi trying to scale, you're really going to be out there banging on doors, basically trying to get people to try your service or switch to your service. And a lot of these companies are going to have an uphill battle doing that, especially in areas where, car ownership is sort of the norm. People have ingrained habits and, you're not really, you don't really have a huge incentive for people to shift over to your service outside of price. Right. But with commercial, there is a clear economic incentive to automate things like freight trucking, right? Because we're in the middle of a huge labor shortage right now, and it's projected to only get worse over the next 10 years. And it's already impacting our supply chain significantly. Look at what's happening right now in the UK with the fuel shortage caused by the shortage of truck drivers they're having there. If they were fully autonomous, right, I think the problem, maybe it wouldn't be so bad. Right. So that's a huge problem. The entire supply chain right now is facing not enough truck drivers and this huge demand boost that we've had in COVID for ordering goods. There's just not enough capacity out there in supply chains. So I think autonomous provides many benefits. A lot of people focus on the safety aspect of it, but I think equally as important is the ability to expand capacity in supply chains and actually enable our economy to grow because, all of these goods that are being stuck in limbo or are being delayed or whatever, all of that can now get put into transit where right now it's just not able to do so.
You mentioned the e-commerce boom during COVID. I want to ask you about a specific slice of that. So I've been working from home and I sit here and order my takeout dinner, my stuff from Amazon. But in terms of food delivery in particular, I'm wondering if the rise of ghost kitchens in dark stores will continue, and will that be accelerated by the availability of last mile or close to last mile delivery bots that can automate those deliveries to me?
Yeah, it absolutely will. And I see automation of that last mile delivery is still something that's in the works. Probably in the next 5 years, we'll see some good applications of that, but there are companies really leading the way on that, like Nuro, for example. They're working with a lot of retailers and food providers, and there's the host of venture-backed startups that are focused on sort of like the sidewalk robot aspect of it. There's a lot of innovation going on in this space, but I think it's sorely needed. And I think in the meantime, I think couriers are going to be really, really important still, and you're going to see technologies that are revolutionizing even that space. Like there's a great company called OneRail, which is venture backed. And they basically created an Airbnb for final mile delivery. So the way it works is if you're a retailer, like a Home Depot or something like that, for example, and you want to deliver goods to a consumer, you will partner with OneRail and they'll basically match you with a courier that can best fit your needs and deliver that to the consumer. And they'll handle the entire experience so that from the consumer's perspective, it looks like everything's being handled by the retail, the exceptions management, the tracking, everything. But OneRail is actually managing all of that back end logistics. So it's models like that, which I think are going to be really, really important going forward, because like you said, we're all at home right now. It's not clear when we're going back. And I think at this point, a lot of these changes in our consumer behavior are ingrained. I order grocery food delivery all the time. You know, even if COVID went away tomorrow, I don't think I would stop doing that just because of the convenience aspect. And things are only getting more convenient. That's the mind-blowing thing to me, is that, you know, just a few years ago, what was there even, what could we even order at home, right? It was like takeout and pizza and that's it. And now we have so many more options, and those options continue to expand with companies like, you know, Uber and DoorDash expanding their offerings into convenience items and other things. And, but also the rise of rapid or ultra fast delivery, which I think is just totally changing the game for a number of reasons. But, you know, they're building these dark stores really close to urban cities that operate out of a tight radius. You can then send out couriers to basically enable, you know, under 10 minute rapid delivery of convenience items, food, you name it. And you know, that business model is very interesting because of the frequency of delivery. It actually enables you to have better sort of contribution margins or better unit economics, because you're actually maximizing the time of the courier much better than you would otherwise. And I think there's a misconception out there about a lot of these businesses being very kind of asset heavy. The real expense with a lot of these businesses is labor. Right? It's the labor cost. How are you utilizing your labor and how are you maximizing it? And I think rapid delivery presents a really interesting paradigm of kind of upending the model of last mile delivery to maximize the sort of drop rates of different couriers. But also, I think it speaks to another trend, which I think is really interesting. You know, we've talked about how investors as a whole, the investor community has done this 180 with regards to mobility as a whole. I think part of that is also just a 180 with regards to the types of businesses they're investing in and focusing on growth instead of profits, and, you know, being willing to back asset heavy business, right? I remember back in, you know, when 2019, when Uber and Lyft went public and they faced all this scrutiny over, you know, their money losing, and all the focus was on when are they going to become profitable? What's the path to profitability look like? How sustainable is this? They're doing all these other things. We want them to focus on software. And I think that was the general mindset of investors. Focus on software. You know, I don't want to invest in hardware. Right now, that mindset has flipped a little bit. And I think venture investors in particular, especially when looking at spaces like mobility and climate tech, it's a little bit of like, you know, mobility 2.0, you know, the 1.0 was investing in the Ubers and Lyfts of the world, which fundamentally act as software intermediaries. Right now, a lot of it's about hardware and ghost kitchens and ghost stores, dark stores, and these really asset-heavy enterprises where you can drive synergies between these different businesses. I think that's very interesting. And last point on this, I know I've talked for a while, but one thing I think is really important is on this subject of rapid delivery and the future of delivery. You know, a lot of people are asking the question, is this just the next big bubble? Right? All this money, all this capital is going into these ultra fast delivery startups. Are these business models ultimately sustainable, and can they drive a profit over the long term? Or is this just VC money subsidizing, you know, convenience, and ultimately it's going to collapse like a house of cards? I think that's a valid question. And I think, you know, ultimately sustainability has to be front and center, economic sustainability. Can you stand on your own once the VC dollars dry up? And so a great example of a company attempting to do that, that we highlight in the report, is a company called Phoenix, F-E-N-I-X. They're based in the Middle East. They go a little bit under the radar when people talk about these big delivery companies, because they're doing things a little bit differently. They're a bit more early stage, but what they're doing is they're combining a last mile delivery service with a micro mobility service. And so, you know, they have a fleet of e-scooters, e-bikes, they service those, they charge those, they operate those out of their dark stores, and their couriers use those to do last mile delivery. But then they also offer those scooters as like a subscription service or a shared mobility service. And so combining those two businesses actually allows them to drive a lot of synergies, because they can share real estate costs across businesses. but also they can dynamically allocate labor, which remember, that's the number one thing, labor between the two businesses as needed. So like during the summer when people were riding scooters a lot, focus on that. During the winter when people are delivering a lot, focus on that. So that's one example. And I think ultimately sustainability is going to be really key to the success of this industry.
Very interesting. Thinking about a startup in the Middle East makes me ask a question about just this whole sector. You mentioned early on that we're in the early innings of this big mobility revolution. Do you see, you know, be it from regulatory reasons or you know, infrastructure reasons or other, is there one region of the world that leads this versus another?
It's tricky. I think the issue I face with when thinking about that is that like mobility is such a broad term and there's so many different ways of like looking at that, whether you look at micromobility or autonomous or whatever, that like it really varies. But in general, I think right now, you know, we're in a race, right? It's North America, Europe, you know, Asia, China, all focusing on, you know, executing on this shift, securing the EV supply chains, investing in infrastructure to support autonomous or micromobility. And I think it's part of this broader push to decarbonize our transportation systems, which is so, so important. And, you know, it's a race that, frankly, I think we need to win as a humanity, because if we don't all, you know, join in this collective effort, everyone's going to suffer, right? Climate change affects us all. And so in terms of, you know, regions of the world that I think are really leading the way, I would call out Europe and the EU, especially with the frameworks they've put out for things like battery recycling and hitting targets for EVs as a percentage of new vehicle sales and encouraging companies to shift to electric. That's going to be really important. And also just frankly, the infrastructure that's there in terms of pushing people out of cars, because like I mentioned with pattern matching, and there's this sense of people want to improve the car to get to where we need to go. But I think we can't solve all of our problems, even if we switched every car to electric and autonomous. We need to get people out of cars to solve our congestion issues and to make mobility more accessible and affordable to everyone, not just the people that can afford, you know, to switch to an autonomous electric car or service. And so, you know, we need to get people out of cars, and we need to get people into smaller, lighter electric vehicles. And I think Europe, with just the infrastructure they have, European cities like Paris, London, they're doing great things in terms of encouraging that shift.
Asad, what's your background and how did you get interested in transportation and mobility in the first place?
Yeah. I think, you know, I've always, ever since I was a little kid, I was always interested in transportation mobility. I've been a car guy my whole life, but I also love tech. And so I think mobility sits at the really interesting intersection of both of those things, which I really love. And so I think, you know, that's kind of what gets me out of bed every morning, is the chance to think about mobility, to learn more about mobility, and to have an impact on, you know, what's being invested in and where things are going with mobility. In terms of my background, studied economics at Harvard. Spent a couple of years at an asset manager, sort of investing in public equities, mostly tech and industrial stocks. Then I joined PitchBook because I was seeing a lot of the innovation coming out of private markets, and I wanted more exposure to that. And so I've been here at PitchBook for 3.5 years, kind of building out our coverage of mobility, focusing on, you know, autonomous, electric, connected, shared. And it's been a fascinating few years to be doing that, for sure.
Be it a book that you read or a class that you took at Harvard or something else, is there any one thing that has made the biggest impact on your view of mobility?
I'll mention something recently that I read that has had an impact, maybe not the biggest impact, but it's this book, Totaled. I don't know if you've read it or seen it. Have you? Okay, yeah, it's a really great book, and it's about this Israeli startup called Better Place, which Yeah, which was basically trying to do EVs before EVs were cool, and had a very different approach, focused on swappable battery packs. And the idea was, you know, everyone's going to shift to EVs, but we're not going to charge. We're going to go to a battery station operated by Better Place. They're going to swap out the battery and replace it for a new one, and it, you know, it'll work great. The company, you know, generated a lot of headlines, raised a ton of capital, and then was a spectacular failure, and had this book written about it, even while Tesla in the meantime was, you know, operating at the sort of same time and had this spectacular success. This has been a really interesting read to me, just reading about like how, you know, in a lot of ways, I think part of it was a business model mismatch. I think part of it was a timing mismatch. They were trying to get a lot of automakers on board during a time where EVs weren't the cool thing to be doing. But also just the business model approach of, you know, this huge, huge infrastructure play at, during a time where I think there wasn't much appetite for that. And I think, you know, it's interesting reading about that story and contrasting that to where we are today, where, you know, you have a company like Ample, which is getting a lot of traction, actually doing something similar, albeit a little bit differently, doing battery cells instead of battery packs. So the infrastructure cost is much lower and, you know, they can achieve profitability much more easily, but also in an environment where automakers are much more interested in this sort of shift and working with a startup like this. So I think it's interesting, you know, given where we are today and seeing how, you know, from the ashes of something that could go so wrong, new sort of paradigms and business models can emerge that maybe have a better chance of success.
And it does bring a question too, you know, Better Place clearly before its time. You know, I think that's one of the big lessons is they had this great idea. The world wasn't ready for it. So I look at these slate of startups out there in transportation today and wonder, you know, what are the great ideas that might just be too early here in the early innings?
Timing is everything, right? I look at startups that maybe just missed out on a funding round and were acqui-hired just before this whole COVID EV mobility craze went off. And I look at others that if this you know, surge in enthusiasm hadn't happened, they might be out of business right now. So things are definitely in flux. It's not clear to me how long this will last. But at the end of the day, I think it's positive overall because the best technologies are going to succeed and they need to succeed for us to get to a future state that is more, you know, sustainable, environmentally sustainable, more ethical, more accessible to everyone. So I'm excited about the future, not just, you know, covering the space today, but I'm excited to see what happens over the next 10, 15 years. I feel like, you know, we're in early innings. We haven't seen anything yet.
Well, Saad, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. This has been a great conversation. Look forward to watching what happens over the next 10 or 15 years. But I hope we talk again long before then.
Likewise, Pete. I'm sure we will. Thanks for having me.
Pete, another great one, great conversation with Saad Hussain. Learned a lot about what's happening with investments in the mobility space. So what did you take away from that conversation?
You know, it's funny, Leslie. I feel like we started out talking about Ford and electrification, and perhaps my biggest takeaway from the conversation with Saad is that we should not only be thinking about automotive and cars, that mobility is much bigger. And certainly we've reflected that on the podcast before. We had Jeff Bauer from Archer Aviation just a few weeks ago. And we're going to reflect that again next week because we'll be talking to Aubrey Donnellan from Bear Flag Robotics, a startup that makes autonomous equipment for farming purposes. So we will continue to reflect that wide scope in mobility. Thanks to Saad for putting a finer point on it. And that's probably it for today. Thank you to our listeners for joining us again. Big thanks to our producer, Eric Jones, and we will see you all next week.